Exodus 3, verse 1. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. And he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. Then he said, Do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. And he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and I have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. Straight over to Chris.
Well, let me add my welcome to Mikey's. It's really good to see you here this lunchtime. I know there are a few here for the first time, so a particular welcome to any for whom that's true. We carry on in Exodus. This is talk three of, I think, five talks at the beginning of the book of Exodus, so we'll be picking it up later on in the year again. The question we're considering today is how it is that we know God. What is God like? I'd like to suggest that there is no way that we can possibly know what God is like unless God makes the first move and makes himself known to us. I mean, as human beings, what else can we do? We can guess, can't we? That's certainly what many people in the ancient world would have had to have done. Would be to guess. I mean, let's consider some of the people that were around during the time in which Moses was writing. There were the Canaanites and the Egyptians. And the Egyptians decided to guess what God was like. And they looked around and they saw that the sun was very powerful. And so they gave the sun a name, Ra. And they gave Ra their worship, their devotion. The Canaanites, who were people living in Canaan, the promised land at the time, well, they looked around and they saw the powerful sort of thunder and lightning, and they gave it the name Baal, and they gave Baal their worship. Personally, bringing it a little bit more up to date, I like the story some of you may have heard before of the five-year-old girl. She was in primary school and she was drawing a picture. Her teacher drew alongside her and said, "That's very interesting. What is it?" And the little girl said, "I'm drawing a picture of God." And the teacher says, but nobody knows what God is like. To which the little girl says, well, they will do when I'm finished. In our world today, I think it's increasingly popular, rather than guessing what God is like, I think it's increasingly popular in our time to assert what we think God is like. You may have heard statements like that. I like to think of God like this, dot, dot, dot. Or, for me, God is somebody who, dot, dot, dot. Or, I couldn't ever believe that God would, dot, dot, dot. And we fashion God into an image that suits our needs as we assert what God is like. But I'd like to suggest where we started. I mean, the fact remains, we can't possibly know what God is like unless God makes the first move and reveals himself to us. And you won't be surprised to hear that's what this section in Exodus that we just heard read is all about. It helps us to understand what God is actually like on terms that God has decided rather than ones that we make up. Sometimes it can be hard to, you read a book like Exodus and it can seem a little bit overwhelming. Where do you begin? Chapter 3 and chapter 4 function as a bit of a unit. They tell a story that sort of builds to a bit of a head. So sometimes it's good to know where the story's going, isn't it, to understand what the purpose of the story is. And if you just glance across to chapter 4, verse 31, you'll see the significance of where we're building to. So just over the page, chapter 4, verse 31, look at that statement at the beginning of verse 31, chapter 4, and the people believed. And the people believed. Now, Moses and his brother Aaron had gone back to the people and told them about the revelation that he had received, and the people believed. Now, we can hear that and think, yeah, that's no big deal. We're always going on about belief, and the Bible's full of such references. But actually, there's only been one other major significant reference to belief in the Bible so far. Abraham believed God. We get that once. And now, for the first time, we see the people believing. So this is a very significant point. It raises the question, doesn't it, of how it is they believe and what it is they believe, and we'll come to that. But we can see what's going on here in terms of what the author of Exodus is aiming at. Belief. Belief in God, God revealed on his terms. A well-known and respected theologian, some of you will have heard of before, Jim Packer, he famously wrote this: once you become aware that the main business that you are here for is to know God, well, most of life's problems fall into place of their own accord. So let's join the story, shall we, at the start of chapter 3. And we catch up with Moses. He's there on the mountain and he's watching his flock. Moses keeping the flock. Significant detail that's happened between the end of chapter 2 and the beginning of chapter 3. We've jumped 40 years in the timeline. What that means is that Moses, the shepherd, you can imagine him with his Gandalf beard, he's 80 years old. He's got his free TV license in his back pocket, of course, and he's out there minding sheep. And there he is, minding his own business, when something very strange happens. Verse 2. The angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And that brings us to the first thing that God reveals about himself. I'm going to call it his uniqueness. God is unique. And I think we see that point from the nature of the flames. The one key feature that we're drawn to twice here is the flame. Look at verse 2, the second half. Moses looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. Look at verse 3. Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. That's a very strange thing, isn't it? It's a visual aid to help us, to help Moses in the first instance, of course, understand God's uniqueness. Now, remember, at this point, Moses had spent 40 years in the palace. He'd also spent 40 years looking after sheep now on the mountainside of Midian. I guess he'd seen some pretty strange and wonderful things through his years in the palace and as a shepherd. But this event caught his attention. This supernatural event, a display of God's power and vitality. What an amazing thing. The ESV unhelpfully calls this the burning bush. We should probably rename it the not burning bush, because that's the whole point. The bush doesn't get burnt. It just keeps on burning. The bush is not consumed. I mean, here is a fire that needed no fuel, a fire that was self-sufficient, self-maintaining. One commentator on this passage says, a flame that was nourished by its own life. I mean, here is God interrupting Moses' life and giving him a very visual display of what he himself is like. And the point that God is making to Moses, I am not constrained by the bounds of nature, as you understand nature, Moses. I have the ability to bend the rules of nature. That's what it means to be God. Unique. Supernatural ability. All of this underscoring his uniqueness. Now, why did Moses need to know that particular characteristic? That God is unique. Well, because God was about to let Moses know that it was time to do something outrageous. It was time to get the people that were in Egypt and to pull them out. And that was a huge thing because they'd been in there for over 400 years and there were a lot of them. So that brings us to the second point. God is uniquely able to do what he promises. Now, this is pretty big news, and so God needs to break this news to Moses gradually, sensibly. And so he starts by reminding Moses who he is. Have a look at verse 6. God says to Moses, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And now, says God, that same God that you are familiar with, Moses, is dealing with you, is making promises to you. And the promise that he makes, well, have a look at verse 7. Here's the substance of what comes. Then the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey. You see the point there. It's time to pull the people out of Egypt. I mean, just think of that proposition for a moment. I think it can be a little bit overwhelming to really understand what it must have felt like for Moses to have heard that promise. Remember, Moses was a pretty sensible chap. He'd spent 40 years being educated in the palace. Okay, he may have had the last four decades on the edge of a mountain with sheep, but his origin was clearly one of education. He would have been able to take on board the gravity of what God was promising. Now, God's people by this stage in Egypt, there were probably 2.5 million of them. Okay, that's quite a conservative estimate. We know by the time they're pulled out, in probably just a few weeks from now in terms of the Bible timeline, we know that there were 600,000 men. So estimates probably 2.5, maybe as many as 3 million if you include women and children. That's quite a big task, pulling 2.5 million people out of a land where they are slaves and taking them to the promised land. I looked on Google Maps. Suez, that's a place in Egypt or very close to Egypt on the edge of it, to Eilat, that's the edge of the promised land. If you go onto Google Maps, that's 300 kilometers. That would take 10 days, best case. Remember, there's children, maybe mum's nursing. Who knows? It could have taken a lot longer, but best case, 10 days. Now they're going to need a lot of food and drink, 2.5 million people. How do you feed that many people? Well, again, average food consumption, I was pretty conservative. Just under 2 kilograms a day would be enough to get by if you're going through a journey like that. Just under 2 kilograms of food. Sounds very manageable. 2.5 million people. If you packed those containers that occasionally go up and down on articulated lorries, if you packed them very carefully, it would fill 165 of those. And Moses would need that sort of delivery every day as he fed the 2.5 million people. As for water, 3 liters a day, 2.5 million people, 3 liters a day, that's 7.5 million liters. An Olympic-sized swimming pool takes 2.5 million liters. That's 3 Olympic swimming pools per day just to keep them from dying. And God says, yeah, it's time to bring that lot and walk them into the promised land. And you're going to do that, you 80-year-old shepherd. I wonder what that was like for Moses. But now back to the promise. You see, perhaps now the burning bush makes a little bit more sense. The overwhelming proposition that was put in front of Moses, well, maybe it begins to sort of make a little bit more sense, look a little bit more manageable. I mean, we've got a unique God who is able to bend the laws of nature. That's a pretty useful sort of attribute to have in your back pocket if you've got to do the task that Moses has just been given. I think it's easy for us to sort of sit here in the sort of relative comfort of London, enjoying our lunch and endless supply of water, and slightly overlook the fact that, of course, for Moses, the task was still at hand. But then, of course, it got even worse. It got way worse before it got better. Look at verse 10. The first thing that Moses had to do before he could take them all to the promised land, well, he had to go and talk to Pharaoh. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh. that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. Now, if you've been with us for the last few weeks as we've gone through Exodus, you'll know that Moses was not exactly flavor of the month when it came to the palace. And so the first step, go and put this proposition before Pharaoh. Not very attractive. I think if we heard that Moses was a little bit worried at this stage, well, I don't think anyone would call him a snowflake, would they, if that was said. Anyway, why don't we read on? We had the first 10 verses. Let's just read on from verse 11 and see what happens with this great proposition before him. So chapter 3, verse 11, I'll just read up to verse 17, and we'll get a little bit more of the story as it's unfurled. So I'll begin in verse 10. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? He said, but I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. Then Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I have observed you and what has been done to you in Egypt, and I promise that I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. Well, it is easy, isn't it, as I've said already, to have some sympathy with verse 11. Who am I, says Moses, that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel up out of Egypt? An impossible-sounding task. And so God addresses this, and you'll see that next point on the handout there. God addresses this more personally. God is actively present with his people as they head to the promised land. God is actively present with his people as they head to the promised land. Notice the first thing that God says to Moses, verse 12. I will be with you. And then God continues to sort of pile on after that, lots of personal references to his involvement. Verse 16, I have observed you and what has been done with you. Verse 17, I will bring you. You see, God is with his people. Now, Moses objects. He can't really manage what's been put before him. And so he says in verse 13, look, God, I'm sorry, but I don't even know your name. You're asking me to do this impossible task. You're asking me to go and convince the elders of Israel to do this impossible task. And I don't even know what you're called. Now, in Moses' day, names were, of course, very significant. We've seen that in the Exodus story so far. In fact, the writer of Exodus has been making it very clear that we need to be looking out for the significance of names. Back in chapter 2, we were told about two babies that were born, and both times we were told the significance of their names. Moses was the first baby born, and we're told that the name Moses means to draw out. That was something that happened to him. You remember he was in the little basket, the little ark in the Nile, and he was drawn out of that. Significant, drawn out of the place of judgment, the River Nile. The other baby that we're drawn attention to, and the other name is Gershom. That was Moses' son. And that sounds like the Hebrew word for sojourner, someone who is not resident in a land, someone who is just passing through. Names today, by contrast, they don't mean very much, do they? We use names basically because we like the sound of them. Parents choose names, ideally, because you know there may be some family significance, probably just because they like the sound of the name, not because of what the name means. I did a little bit of research, thought I'd try and embarrass at least one of the members of the team, and anybody else, if you happen to share the name Michael, as in Mikey, who introduced us today, and I looked up what Mikey's name means. And Michael, as Mikey well knows, means who is like God. So the name is itself a rhetorical question. Every time you see Mikey, you should be thinking, who is like God? And that's on his parents, because they obviously thought, right, this little baby is going to be a perfect illustration of somebody who is not like God. Now, you see, when the Bible was written, names, of course, were hugely significant. And so when Moses asked God for his name, he was asking God to describe his very essence. He wanted to know, what lies at the heart of your character, God? I want to know your name, what you stand for. I want to know your character. What does God say in response? Verse 14. I am who I am. And he said, say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. I am who I am. In other words, this is God saying that at the heart of his being, God's essence is his isness. God's essence is his isness. I was thinking about this a lot. It's a little bit confusing, isn't it? It's all very well to keep asserting, here is God's name, I am who I am. He's trying to describe himself as always present and always applicable, I am. It doesn't make a lot of sense, but I think it makes more sense as, of course, we compare God to ourselves. Let me illustrate what I mean. If we go back to the 60s, I didn't exist. Some of you here definitely did. I didn't, and so I could not say I am in the 60s because I couldn't speak. I didn't exist. In the 70s, in the early 70s, I still couldn't speak, although I was around. By the late 70s, I could definitely speak. And at that point, I would have been able to say, I am. And that would be true in the 80s and the 90s and the noughties. And more recently, today I can say, I am. Tomorrow, I hope, I can say, I am. In 100 years' time, I'll be dead. And I won't be able to say, I am in this world. But you see, God, on the other hand, at every point in time, and at every point, if there is such a thing, before time, whatever that means, God has always been able to say, I am. So this, of course, describes God's eternal nature. He is the eternally present I am. He doesn't depend on anybody else for life. He is self-existent, self-sufficient. Perfectly illustrated, of course, by the uniqueness of the flame. At every point in time, God is the same. He was yesterday, the I am. He is today, the I am. And when I've been with him in eternity for 10 billion years, the best way for God to describe himself is by saying, I am. Now, there's a little bit of a complication in the text, which I don't want to duck. So just have a glance at verse 15. You see, I am who I am is not the only name that God uses for himself. Verse 15, God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers. It's a little bit confusing, isn't it? God has just said, my name is I am who I am. And now he says, it's the Lord. Well, I think you may find this useful if you haven't heard this before. Many will be familiar with this. But every time in the Bible, the English translation of the Bible that we have, when you see the word Lord capitalized, then the Bible is translating the name for God, the Hebrew name for God, Yahweh. Okay, and that's a bit of a mouthful for us in English. And so we get the Lord. It's particularly interesting because, of course, the Hebrew name for God, Yahweh, sounds very like the Hebrew word for the verb to be, which makes sense, doesn't it? If God is I am who I am, which, of course, is the verb to be, essentially. Don't worry about that if that's a little bit confusing. The point is, every time you read the word Lord, capital letters, you've got to think, this is God's name. This is I am who I am. This is Yahweh. Every time you see Lord capitalized. And the point for us, just to bring it back to reality, God's name, hugely significant. What it means, of course, is that God is intimately, personally present in every situation. That was a very, very significant and necessary thing for Moses to be told at this point with the task at hand. God intimately present with his people. That, of course, is why he keeps on saying, I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. I am their God. I continue to be their God. I will be their God forever. And Moses, I am your God. In fact, I am. One writer puts it like this: in no situation is God an ornamental extra. In every situation, he is actively present. And so that's pretty useful for Moses, pretty daunting task, millions of people. He needed God's assurance. He needed proof that, of course, God was able to do what he had said he would do. Uniquely able, he has power over nature. Supernaturally present, I will be with you. And he'll take him safely all the way to the promised land. Moses, of course, was very privileged to be given this revelation, but, of course, we, at our stage in salvation history, here in London, we have so much more, don't we? I mean, think of Jesus as he breaks onto the scene. Think of his unique displays of power, his miracles, each one displaying supernatural ability. I know every time Jesus does a miracle, and of course there are countless miracles that Jesus did, many of which we have recorded in the four gospel accounts, each one displaying his supernatural power. I can bend the laws of nature to do what I want, Jesus is partly saying. Uniquely able. It's also easy, isn't it, to see why Jesus causes such a stir. As he breaks onto the scene and he has lots of conversations with people, one of the names that he uses for himself is the name that God reveals to Moses. You remember when Jesus is speaking to the establishment, he says, before Abraham was, I am. No wonder they were pretty shocked at the time. And then, of course, as we think of Jesus' final words in the gospel accounts to his disciples and to all who would follow, he says, go and make disciples of all nations. Go and tell the world that they'll only understand the purpose of life with reference to me is essentially the message. And Jesus says, yeah, that's a daunting task, but don't worry, I am with you. I am with you always. I mean, our situation now for Christians here today is so similar to the people then in many ways. We're not slaves in Egypt, but the Bible consistently paints Egypt as a picture, a paradigm of the slavery that we're in today. Slavery to sin. Slavery which leads us, of course, naturally to make crazy assertions about God. I like to think of God like ... Jesus warns that has serious consequences. But God came to rescue us. And so the challenge is very simply this from today's passage. I mean, in whom will you place your trust? Will we trust God? Will we trust God as he has revealed himself? Not the God that we want to make up or assert, but God as he has revealed himself. You see, God is uniquely able to do what he says. He has the power to go with us all the way. He's made some outrageous promises to take us from this world to heaven, the promised land. So if you've been brought along here today, you're looking into Christian things, which will be true for a number of people here. I wonder what you make of this, God. I mean, what do you think the business in life really is? Remember that quote. I mean, once you become aware that the main business that you're here for is to know God, well, most of life's problems, they fall into place on their own accord. So whatever life holds, I mean, do you really want to trust yourself, your own abilities in life, your own knowledge, your own understanding to make sense of this world, to make sense of life as you face the grave ultimately? Or do you want to trust in a God who has promised to take us safely from this life, through all of the mess that we'll no doubt be involved in at different times, significantly through the grave to the promised land. That's the choice before us. Ourselves or this God. Exodus is there to help us to absorb God on his terms and to chip away at our natural tendency to want to define God on our terms. He is uniquely able to do what he has promised. And for those who trust in him, he will carry us safely all the way to the promised land. Now that is a wonderful, wonderful thing to be thinking about in the middle of a busy working week. I hope that's given a little bit of fuel for conversation. I'm going to hand back to Mikey now just to close off our time.